Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. We'll be reading together today World Radio Magazine, the online version, for February 2012. The editor is Richard Fisher. Call KI6SN. World Radio is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handyham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Our website, www.handyham.org. Let's begin with World Radio News Front. Michael Copps steps down from FCC. After serving more than a decade, Michael Copps resigned his seat on the Federal Communications Commission January 1 of this year. Only three sitting commissioners may be members of the same political party, Chairman Julius Janikowski, Copps, and Mignon Claiborne are Democrats. Robert McDowell is the lone Republican since Meredith Atwell Baker left the commission in June of 2010. Copps has served as a commissioner since May 2001. In January 2009, he was acting FCC chairman following the resignation of then FCC chairman Kevin J. Martin. Copps relinquished the chairmanship to Julius Janikowski after Janikowski was confirmed by the U.S. Senate and sworn into office in June 2009. Our next piece, Fast Track 1, is up and running as a DigiPeter. The Fast Track 1 satellite, that's F-069, became operational in December as a packet radio DigiPeter, according to the American Radio Relay League letter. Anyone with a 1200 baud packet TNC and a VHF slant UHF FM transceiver can try it, the posting said. If you own satellite tracking software, you'll find the latest orbital elements on the Fast Track, that's spelled F-A-S-T-R-A-C-E, website. The Fast Track 1 uplink is at 145.825 MHz with a downlink at 437.345 MHz. The DigiPeter alias is Fast 1, F-A-S-T, numeral 1. To connect to ARRL headquarters station W1AW through Fast Track 1, for example, you would send the following packet. This is uppercase. The letter begins with C, space, W1AW, space, VIA, space, FAST1, the ARRL letter said. Reports of your results are welcome via email, and it goes to fasttracksats@gmail.com. Well, there seems to be some shenanigans over there in Great Britain. RGSB reorganizes to save itself. Beset by a scandal in which its former general manager allegedly stole thousands of pounds from the organization, the Radio Society of Great Britain, the acronym is RSGB, has undertaken a major reorganization to try to stay afloat. At an extraordinary general meeting, and that was in quotations, of the society in late 2011, RSGB members voted overwhelmingly to adopt a reform committee proposal to temporarily place the elected board of directors with an interim board made up of eight amateurs with significant business and financial expertise. According to the RSGB website, these directors will serve for 15 months, will take necessary actions to put the society back on a sound financial footing, and make recommendations to the membership for future governance. We thank CQ Newsline for that input. Guitarists uses ham radio cash to launch 70s punk band. A young guitarist from the 1970s used money from his amateur radio accessories business to found the cult punk rock band Black Flag. In 1967, at the age of 12, Greg Ginn, G-I-N-N, Ramacher Call, WB6ZNM, started his own business, Solid State Transmitters, SST. It was a mail-order business that sold modified World War II surplus radio equipment. He founded the band Blag Flag, and here it's spelled B-L-A-G-F-L-A-G, originally called Panic, in 1976, using money generated by his company, now trading as SST Electronics. In the early days, all the band members were at some point involved in making antenna tuners or other ham radio accessories to raise money to finance Black Flag. Ginn, the guitarist's primary songwriter and sole continuous member through multiple personnel changes in the band from 1976 through 1986. According to FCC Universal Licensing System records, Ginn no longer appears to be an active radio amateur. That contribution was by Southgate News Service. Let's move along now to the editor's log. The editor is Richard Fisher, amateur call KI6SN. The amateur's code at 85. Needed now as much as ever. While working on a homebrew project in late 2011, I was listening to a group going at it on 40-meter single sideband. Why they were so mad at each other was never really clear, but the expletives and threats were flying. To the scrum's credit, operators declared ceasefire every 10 minutes to identify themselves. Then the war raged again, replete with Star Wars sound effects, a recording of the USC fight song, and the Whistler rivaling 2011 international champ Terry Rappold. Drama like this must put Paul M. Siegel, S9EAA and W3EEA, Silent Key, into a subterranean spin. It was Mr. Siegel, the American Radio League's general counsel from 1928 to 1961, who wrote, this is a title, The Amateur, His Code, published in QST Magazine 85 years ago this month. I remember reading The Amateur's Code in 1965 as a newly minted novice. My call then was WN1DWL. I hand-copied and tacked it to the wall above my novice station. Radio amateurs ideally operate and live by those six commandments, our code of ethics. To be clear, Mr. Siegel was not some stuffed shirt sticking the mud bureaucrat. A QST tribute to W3EEA prior to his death in 1968 revealed a playful side. Here's a quote. While Paul was studying law in Denver, he worked for one of the local broadcast stations, the tribute said. Late at night after the station went off the air in its broadcast capacity, Paul put it back on the air as a ham station. As W3EEA in Washington, D.C., Mr. Siegel operated his station remotely, controlling it with a 3.5-mile private landline. With the amateur's code, though, he helped define for us all the bounds of good operating in common sense. Setting aside its men's club and league-centric focus, here is Mr. Siegel's gentle reminder to those fellas on 40-meter single sideband and amateurs on all bands everywhere. The short list begins with, the amateur is loyal. He owes his amateur radio to the Amateur Radio Relay League, and he offers it his unswerving loyalty. The amateur is progressive. He keeps his station abreast of science. It is built well and efficiently. His operating practice is clean and regular. The amateur is friendly, slow and patient, sending when requested friendly advice and counsel to the beginner, kindly assistance and cooperation for the broadcast listener. These are the marks of the amateur spirit. The amateur is balanced. Radio is his hobby. He never allows it to interfere with any of his duties he owes to his home, his job, his school, or his community. Him and you would argue at that point, fellows and gals. The amateur is patriotic. His knowledge and his station are always ready for the service of his country and his community. In researching Mr. Siegel's Code of Ethics, I found it interesting that the ARRL appended several more guidelines to the code under the dark clouds of a protracting world war. Remember, folks, this goes back a long way. It was a little more than a year before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. It's titled Points in Extending ARRL Code of Conduct for All U.S. Radio Amateurs from August 1940, QST Magazine. Point. Do not talk about the war over the air, even among ourselves, or any happenings that might have military significance. Our signals may be intercepted by belligerents. Point. Do not use any code or cipher. Use plain language, English recommended. Point. Do not permit anyone except members of your immediate family or other licensed amateurs who are at the time in possession of their FCC license to use the microphone of your phone station. Phone is speech. Point. Sign each transmission with your assigned call. Follow every FCC regulation with utmost care. Point. Scrutinize domestic traffic offered you by strangers. If you are approached by an agent of a subversive group or an agent of a foreign country, communicate immediately with the nearest office of the FBI or via the ARRL. Let us not forget the freedoms so many fought selflessly to preserve that allow amateur radio operators across the United States today to enjoy this hobby. Let us not take for granted, as well, the use of our airwaves and operating privileges. We would not want an attitude of anything goes to lead to everything went. And it's signed Richard Fisher, KI6SN. One of our first major pieces in the magazine Today Online is with the Handy Hams, a new strategy for helping the blind ham. This is part two. Author is Patrick Tice, WA0TDA. Pat is the director of the Courage Handy Ham System in the United States and elsewhere. At Handy Hams, we decided to stop recording instruction manuals and start teaching people how to use the equipment. It is much more effective because the teacher is actually showing the student how to use the radio. It is much like taking a driver training course versus just reading the car owner's manual. That was Patrick Tice's commentary to introduce the text. In January, with the Handy Hams, we learned how to use the free open source software Audacity to record on a personal computer. Now it's time to take it to the next level and make some audio recordings that can help blind operators understand their radios, enjoy your club's newsletter, or have access they would not otherwise have to material that is available only in print. Of course, there are lots of uses for audio editing skills, and you may find the knowledge useful in publicizing your club via social media sites, podcasts, and who knows what else. You may even decide to make audio of your club's meetings available to members who cannot attend. In part two, we are going to address a real need in the community of blind amateur radio operators, and that is access to clear, easy-to-follow directions on how to use various transceivers and accessories. Think of how challenging it would be to unbox that brand-new radio, feeling the various controls and connectors, figuring out what pieces are in the poly bags, and wondering how best to proceed when you cannot see or read the manual. Of course, some of it will be intuitive, and I know blind hams who can figure out most everything about hooking up the new radio completely on their own. The print manual that comes with the radio will get handed to a sighted family member for interpretation. Thus, the process of setup will proceed, often with the help of an unlicensed relative who doesn't understand many of the terms and who can't describe the diagrams. When I first started working with the Handy M program in 1991, volunteers would read rig instruction manuals cover to cover, recording onto cassette tape. When the recordings were received at Handy M HQ, master tapes were made and copies were then available to Handy M members with that particular radio. The problem with this kind of recording is that if you have a question about how a particular setting is changed, let's say keying speed, to find the right part of the manual, you will have to listen through lots of stuff you don't really need. Furthermore, without diagrams, the recordings were often confusingly incomplete. PDF manuals available online make it much easier to simply open a PDF reader and perform a keyword search for keying speed. Blind hams, being techie people, usually have internet access and know how to use screen reading software. In fact, they can read the entire instruction manual, but they may still find it incomplete because it is hard to keep the text in context and the diagrams are not explained. We decided to stop recording instruction manuals and start teaching people how to use the equipment. This is done with audio recordings as well, but it is much more efficient because the teacher is actually showing the student how to use the radio. It is much like taking a driver training course versus just reading the car owner's manual. And just like that driver training course, the instructor knows how to drive the car well from years of experience. As the owner of a radio you know about and use every day, you are a well-qualified instructor, but you do have to know how to teach. It's easier than you might think, but as with any skill, will take a bit of practice. The basics of teaching how to use a radio. Let's start with the right mindset. You are not going to need to teach everything about the radio. And you will not need to record the instruction manual. What you will need to do is tell a new user about the radio at a very basic level and do it as if you are teaching via telephone. Begin with a description of how the radio looks. Describe the front panel, starting at the upper left and working your way across the layout of the dials and buttons in what you think is the logical way. You can start on the right if that seems better to you, but be consistent. Taking a look at my own transceiver, the ICOM IC7200, which is pictured on page 29, the upper right corner, I may decide to try to create a visualization of the front panel in a more general way at first, and then return to various parts of the front panel, such as the keypad on the right-hand side, to go over each button in more detail. So if I do that, I will probably begin with an overview of the front panel by explaining that the speaker is in the upper left corner and that you can feel the horizontal bars that protect the speaker cone inside. Below that, in the lower left corner, is the microphone connection. Immediately to the right of the microphone connection is the 0.25-inch headphone jack. Next, you will find a pair of over and under controls. The one to the immediate right of the speaker is the twin passband tuning and consists of concentric controls. Both controls have a detent at the 12 o'clock position. Just below the passband tuning and to the immediate right of the headphone jack, you will find the AF, that's the volume control, with a concentric RF slant squelch control at the rear. Neither of these controls has a detent position. I will then go on to explain the center third of the front panel with the frequency display, the main tuning knob, the power switch, the built-in speech frequency synthesizer button to the immediate right of the power switch, and so on. In this first generation description of the front panel, I am not going into any detail on the control since I am simply giving a general overview of the front panel. It is like after I have gone through this general overview that I will get more specific about what each key does. Teacher knows best. Now, that is where you get to be a true teaching professional. As a user of the radio yourself, you know that certain controls will get used every time that the radio is in service, while other controls are seldom used, and some may virtually never get used except under very special circumstances. So at this next level of teaching, you are probably going to want to make sure that the user can find the power switch, the speech frequency readout button, the main tuning knob, the volume control, and the keypad for direct frequency entry. Of course, the user will also have to know similar basics about the back of the radio in order to connect the power cable and the feed line. Why teaching the radio is not the same as reading the manual? At this point, teaching how to turn the radio on and adjust the volume would be more important than how to use the noise blanking circuit. The idea is to teach your student how to use the radio at a basic level, making certain he or she knows how to operate well enough to find out what frequency the radio is on, how to change frequencies, how to choose the correct mode of operation, how to adjust the volume control, and so on. It will only be later on that you will talk about some of the radio's more esoteric features. There is no need to feel as if you have to teach every feature of the radio. You can feel free to refer your student to the PDF version of the manual online at the manufacturer's website for some of these lesser used adjustments and features. So now let's go through the lesson planning. You might want to sketch out a simple lesson plan for how you are going to teach. Introduction. Say who you are and what radio you are going to be talking about. Give the complete model number and manufacturer along with the whatever remarks you may wish to make about how long you own the radio and the type of operation with it that you prefer. Map the radio. This is where we talk about where things are located on the radio. Depending on how complicated the radio is, you may need several layers of description. For instance, front panel general description, rear panel general description, front panel basic operations description covering the most likely used controls for operating the radio, rear panel detailed hookup and accessories. Now, with regard to putting their radio on the air, this could be a tutorial that includes a step-by-step process from turning the radio on to determining what the frequency readout display says, direct frequency entry using the keypad, tuning around the frequency with the main tuning dial, changing the mode of operation if necessary, locating and tuning in a signal on the air, and determining if it is in a part of the band where the user has transmitting privileges, and so on. At some point, you might decide that the basic part of your tutorial is complete. The next tutorial, or series of tutorials, might then cover progressively more detailed use of the front panel to access the radio's other features. It is still important to stick with those features that are most likely to be needed in typical day-to-day operation. Noise reduction and passband tuning should be addressed soon in this next level of training, as should the noise blanker, the preamp, and the attenuator. As you move through these audio tutorials, you are helping the new user learn the radio in a very logical way. First things first, again, comparing it to learning to drive a car, your driving instructor did not start you out with a lesson on how to operate the power moonroof. Instead, with your first driving lessons, you learn how to adjust the seat, the mirror, the driving controls, and the seat belt. In a similar manner, you are going to be teaching a new user the most essential basics of a transceiver before telling him about the lesser used features. Since you know and use the transceiver yourself, you are in a good position to judge the most commonly used and essential controls and features. Thus, there is no absolute right or wrong way to construct your lesson plan. It all depends on the radio and your approach to teaching. Add interest by including sounds. Since you are making an audio recording, you can feel free to include sounds from the radio, such as when you are teaching about the voice frequency readout, or when you are talking about the noise reduction and demonstrating the difference as you switch the noise blanker on and off in the presence of an annoying noise. Some radios have more speech feedback for blind users than others. If the radio you are teaching about, such as the new Kenwood TS-590S, has the optional VGS-1 speech module installed, you can then include audio from the speech module as you talk about going through the menu settings. Now, preparing for challenges. Include some preemptive advice on how to avoid problems and troubleshoot the ones that do show up. I like to include a tutorial on nothing but troubleshooting. This can include your thoughts on how to figure out what is wrong if the radio is not behaving as expected. This usually happens when a button gets pressed by accident or putting the radio into some sort of non-standard operation, such as scan mode, split operation, or Vox, V-O-X. Because you know how to use the radio, you are likely to know about the most common gotchas related to that model. For example, I might say, the radio can easily be put into split operation if you forget to press the enter key prior to entering a frequency on 75 meters. As soon as you press the 3, intending to go on 3.9 megahertz, you instead put the radio in split mode because split, S-P-L-I-T, is also the numerical 3 key. Make it easy to review. There's not much sense in creating one big audio tutorial file that is 3 hours long. It is much better to create smaller, more focused files on specific topics. You can give each smaller file a logical name describing the contents, or you can simply give each a numerically arranged name, such as 01-IC7200, 02-IC7200, and so on. The file extension will be MP3, the preferred and most universal audio file on the web. If you don't use file names that say what the content is about, you can always include a text file table of contents. That way, the user does not have to wade through a lot of content to locate a specific concept about how to use a control. Finalize and prepare your submission. Your audio project may now contain multiple files, any one of which is far too large to be sent as an email attachment. Keep all of the files for a given project in a single digital folder and give that folder an easily recognized descriptive name, such as ICOM-IC-7200 Audio Tutorials. This will help you keep everything organized. Within a folder, make sure that all of the files are present and logically named in the proper order. Remember that the listener will have to know where to begin listening. Now, with regard to sending those big files, if you are planning to submit your project for use by HandyHams, you will need to figure out how to get those big files sent to us. There are several file sending and sharing services that can handle large files, such as YouSendIt, that's one word, .com, YouSendIt.com, that's http://www.YouSendIt.com, or Dropbox.com, that's http://www.dropbox.com. I use Dropbox, which is intuitive and easy. It is easier to use these services if you turn the project folder into a single zip file. In Windows 7, you do this by right-clicking on the folder, going to Send To, and choosing Compressed Folder. This creates a single zip file that includes all of your individual files. So, it is easier to handle. Send the single file using whatever service you select after letting us know that you are planning to send it so that we can be ready. Another way to send us your recordings is by putting them onto a data CD and simply sending the disc in the mail. A typical single CD in a cardboard CD mailer takes 2 stamps for first class. Now, one last thought. If you want to listen to how one of our ham operators does it, listen to how N3AIN, November 3, Alpha India November, N3AIN does it. You'll have to have internet connectability for this, but if you're patient and you want to really listen to something that's very well done, I'll give this to you. Every instructor will have his or her own way of teaching. Listen to Joe Bogwist, B-O-G-W-I-S-T, amateur call N3AIN of Hazleton, Pennsylvania, as he tells us how to use the Kenwood TS-480SAT. Now, here's that website address. It's a little tricky, so listen closely. http://bit.ly/tbkiex. Now, some of those are upper and some are lower cases. I'm not going to make that distinction. If it works for you, fine. Otherwise, I couldn't do much better. I would only confuse you. These are some of the new kinds of printouts that apparently are coming into the magazines that we read, and they don't have the familiar Word plus .com kind of thing on them, and even I'm having trouble getting that down absolutely correctly myself, folks. But there you have it. Now, if you'd like to contact the Courage Handy Hem System, Pat Tice says, I hope you will consider recording for amateur radio operators who cannot use regular print. Send your correspondence to Courage Center Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, MN, zip code 55422. You can reach them at area 763-520-0512. Or you could email to one word, hamradio, at couragecenter, one word, .org, hamradio@couragecenter.org, or go to the website, http://www.handyham.org. That concludes the commentary with the Handy Hams, titled A New Strategy for Helping the Blind Ham, Part 2, by Patrick Tice, WA0TDA. Continuing with the February 2012 issue of World Radio Online, we'll talk about Morse code. The 2011 Field Day statistics show CW, continuous wave, that's Morse code, is stronger than ever. The author here is Randall Noon, amateur call KC0CCR. Having received several requests to do so after the 2011 Field Day statistics were published, this column updates one I wrote about a year ago about the status of amateur radio, especially the status of CW, since the Morse test was dropped from U.S. amateur licensing requirements. The Federal Communications Commission on December 15, 2006, announced the official notice that CW testing would no longer be required to obtain any amateur license in the United States. The last required CW tests were given in the 30-day period after the official announcement. Many of the testing sessions in that 30-day period were packed. Some candidate hams wanted to have bragging rights about getting their licenses when the last CW tests were given. Many dire predictions were made concerning the future of ham radio, and in particular the future of CW or Morse code usage when the code test was discontinued. Some predicted that CW would die out. Others said ham radio itself was dying because of the internet, and that dropping the CW test was an obvious symptom. It has now been a full 5 years since CW testing stopped. Let's examine the facts, at least to some degree here, to determine what has happened since the change was made. How did the change affect licensing? With respect to the total number of amateur radio licenses in the United States, there is now more licensed U.S. amateur radio operators than at any time in U.S. amateur radio history. The author presents a table on page 8, which is based upon the total number of U.S. licenses at the end of October. As the figures indicate, there had been a slight downward trend in the total number of ham licenses for 3 years, from 2005 to 2007. However, the trend reversed in 2008 and has been upward each year since. In a country of more than 300 million people, 0.24% currently are licensed amateur radio operators. That is a remarkable percentage. Only Japan, with a population of 127 million and 1,300,000 licensed operators, can boast a higher percentage, 1%. Since the CW licensing changes were made in early 2007, and since there are no other significant licensing factors that have changed since then, the change in U.S. amateur licensing requirements directly correlates with the increase in U.S. licensed amateurs. So, who are they? Are these active hams or just hams who took the test and don't get on the air? To answer this, I went to the data published by the ARRL concerning field day participation for the same period. The assumption is that people who participate in field day are at least minimally active hams. The figures indicate that the percentage of field day participants as compared to the total number of licensed hams in each year dropped slightly, perhaps insignificantly, from 2005 to 2006. However, the percentage of field day participants increased from 2006 to 2009, dropped slightly in 2010, and then increased to a record percentage of entries in 2011. These numbers indicate that field day participation is not increased simply because the number of licensed hams has increased. More hams now participate in field day, both in absolute numbers and as a percentage of the total number of licensed hams. Again, the increase in participation appears to have begun in 2007, when the licensing change occurred. So, just what's going on? The numbers indicate that both CW and phone have increased in absolute numbers since 2005. There were a record number of Field Day 2011 entries, a record number of participants, a record number of digital QSOs, and the highest number of CW QSOs in 17 years. And consider the fact that sunspots are not even at maximum yet. More spots and better band conditions are yet to come. As a percentage of each year's QSOs, both the CW and phone modes have slightly declined due to the corresponding rise in digital QSOs. In other words, digital is stealing a little of the QSO pie from both CW and phone. The absolute number of digital QSOs in 2011 was more than double what it was in 2005. Now, in conclusion, CW use among hams, as measured by field day statistics, has not significantly dropped in the 5 years since testing ceased in 2007. It not only appears to be holding its own, but the use of CW, again, that's Morse code, folks, in absolute numbers has significantly increased. The gain in licensed hams since 2005, which is 5.4%, is more than matched by the gain in CW QSOs made on field day, an increase of 14.7% in the same period. If the no-code era hams have eschewed CW, the numbers do not show it. As noted last year, the numbers also indicate that the newer hams licensed in 2007 are bringing into the hobby computer-based communication skills in addition to the traditional CW and phone modes. Now, some people would say, IMHO, in my humble opinion, this is a good development. The internet isn't making amateur radio obsolete. To the contrary, the two methods of communication have forged a partnership. Last, the numbers indicate that the end of CW testing did not herald the end of CW, as many predicted. But then again, the continued use of CW after testing was discontinued should have been expected. Radio amateurs have not used CW because there was a test. CW has been used because it has been and continues to be a very useful mode of wireless communications. The author concludes his commentary in Morse code area with FISTS, F-I-S-T-S, 25th anniversary in the year 2012. Congratulations to FISTS, the International Morse Code Preservation Society, which was founded 25 years ago by G3ZQS, Golf 3, Zulu, Quebec, Sierra, George Longden. FISTS has chapters in Asia, Europe, North America, and Australia, and has thousands of members. Congratulations to all of those who made that anniversary happen. You know, folks, my goodness, I just realized I haven't given you any information yet on HebFest and special events, or even a contest corner. I have to catch my breath and give you some news about February for HebFests and special events. HebFests are like flea markets for people who try to sell and do other things, you know what I mean. So let's start out with Washington, Pennsylvania. The Washington Amateur Communications Incorporated will air a special event station, W3C, Whiskey 3 Charlie, from the Washington County Sportsman Show in Washington Crown Center Shopping Mall. And that's going to be from Thursday, February 2nd to Sunday, February 5th, during the hours of 1500 UTC and 2200 UTC. Lubbock, Texas, special event station W5B, Whiskey 5 Bravo, will be on the air Friday, February 3 to Sunday, February 5, commemorating the 53rd anniversary of Buddy Holly's death, all the various frequencies. If you like to listen in on special event stations, you'll find them somewhere on the amateur bands. Richmond, Virginia, the Richmond Amateur Telecommunications Society will hold Frost Fest 2012, Saturday, February 4, from 9 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. at the Richmond Raceway Complex, Charleston, South Carolina, the 39th annual Charleston HebFest and Computer Show. They're going to hold on Saturday, the 4th of February, from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Exchange Park Fairgrounds on 9850 Highway 78. So if you're heading south, you snowbirds, or if you're coming back because you think it's almost spring in the New England area, I doubt that, try to swing off of 95 and catch the Charleston, South Carolina 39th Annual HebFest and Computer Show. You folks out in Phoenix, Arizona, and Prescott, Arizona, the Central Arizona DX Association will air special event station K7UGA, K7 Uniform Golf Alpha, to salute the 100th anniversary of Arizona statehood. And as an aside, folks, I believe K7UGA is actually late Senator Barry Goldwater's famous call from Arizona. And the date for that is going to be Monday, February 13th to Sunday, February 19th. Our operations will be on all amateur bands from 160 to 2 meters and all the different modes. So if you're anything into listening for ham radio, you're bound to pick them up. I know as an amateur radio operator myself, over the years, I was privileged to make contact with the Barry Goldwater station when he was still operating. It's a very famous station. If you were to see the picture of the location, it's mind-boggling how much Barry put into his amateur radio hobby, beside the great work he did for our nation. And I suppose I shouldn't forget our good friends in South Burlington, Vermont. The Radio Amateurs of Northern Vermont is sponsoring HamCom, Ham-Com, from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday, February 25th at the Holiday Inn Convention Center. That's on exit 14 of Interstate 89. And, of course, portion of this transmission actually is going through the Massachusetts Reading Network, the Talking Information Center, in their Leisure Pursuits program, which I've been privileged to read for quite a few years now. So for you New England hammers that are listening on the Massachusetts Reading Network, why don't you take a run up to South Burlington and enjoy the Radio Amateurs of Northern Vermont sponsoring of HamCom. And if you'd like to get involved with contests, well, the very first one on the list is Minnesota CUSO Party. You've heard a lot of conversation from Minnesota today, folks, whether you realized it or not, because the Courage Handy Hemp System is headquartered in Golden Valley, which is actually a suburb of Minnesota. They're having their CUSO Party. 1400 Zulu to 2359 Zulu on February 4. That's next weekend, all bands. And lo and behold, we have Vermont's CUSO party. This is not planned. I read these as I see them, folks. So here's Vermont's again now. This is on February 4th through February 5th, 40 through 10 meter, single sideband, CW and digital, the Vermont CUSO party. 1010 International Winter Phone Contest. That's a really big one because that's where people literally talk. Phone is speaking voice. It's Zero Zulu February 4th through 2359 Zulu February 5 on 10 meters single sideband. That's always a great contest for working DX or distant international stations outside of the contiguous boundaries of the United States. And I might add one other thought. Now that the sunspots are really going wild out there, from the sun's cresting on its latest sunspot curve, the reception ought to be fantastic. So if you're at all into listening or working with a ham radio on 10 meters, look for the February 4 through 5 weekend for the 1010 International Winter Phone Contest. And I think I'll stay in New England for one more. Our good friends in New Hampshire, they're having their CUSO party as well at 1600 Zulu February 11th to 0400 Zulu February 12th, and again at 1200 Zulu to 2200 on February 12th. I don't know why the split times, but they are February 11th and 12th. And that's 160 to 10 meters, all modes. So if you're local in New England and you want to work some of the shorter hop bands, that'll be a good one to get involved with, the New Hampshire CUSO party. And you've heard me mention the ARRL, the American Radio Relay League. Their international DX party is going to be on all bands from 160 to 10 meters in Morse code, DX. So that's the weekend of February 18 and 19. And one more very worthy of mention is the CQ Worldwide 160-meter contest, single sideband phone. That's on February 24th to 26th. So you can see February is a very, very active time for the wonderful hobby of amateur radio because you can talk to somebody anywhere at any time in the United States or across the world by just listening and transmitting. And remember to play by those good rules that we talked about earlier in this broadcast so as not to get anybody's feathers ruffled. Now here's a change of pace, WRO Watch, new products. The author here is Jason Feldman, WPC2COD. Tentec introduces U-Kits, that's Y-O-U-K-I-T-S, HB-1B, 4-band CW-QRP transceiver. QRP is low power, between 1 and 5 watts. Ham's looking for a new CW-QRP transmitter that is trail-friendly. Should look at the U-Kits HB-1B 4-band CW-QRP transceiver. Using the latest advances in SMT and DDS technology, the HB-1B provides 80, 40, 30, and 20-meter CW transmitting with 3.2 through 16 megahertz general coverage receive capabilities, according to Tentec, the exclusive U.S. distributor of HB-1B. The features include a variable four-pole crystal filter, receive incremental tuning, that's RIT, memory storage for up to 30 frequencies, and an automatic CQ and call sign sending function. You could use the H1B one with the straight key or your favorite key paddle. Power consumption is 60 milliamps on receive and 800 milliamps on transmit. The H1B1 can operate from an external 12 to 14 volt DC regulated power source or an optional internal lithium battery pack. The unit comes packed into a 5.2 times 3.4 times 1.4 inch case that is rugged and weighs 14 ounces, so you can see it's rather small. An LCD display informs you of frequency, mode, supply voltage, S-meter, and RIT. The U-Kits HB-1B has an MSRP, manufacturer's suggested retail price, of $299, and is available through Tentec Incorporated. Their website is www.tentec.com. www.tpconf.com. That's http://www.tentec.com. And the whole unit weighs only 14 ounces, not including the batteries. That's a great little rig that you can go around with. It mentioned trail friendly, but it's easy to store because of its size. It's like two or three packs of cigarettes laid together. And that's really very convenient. Beautiful stuff, and they make very, very good equipment. So if you're into that low power output and receivability, that it's a good item to check out, especially if you're already into it a little bit and want to upgrade to a better piece of equipment. Let's take a peek now at the YL's Young Ladies in Amateur Radio. YL's Connect to Infinity and Beyond. The author of the article, Jennifer Oliver O'Connell, amateur call KI6OIL. Welcome to 2012. I hope everyone had a wonderful holiday season and that Santa brought to each of you a new rig, HT, or antenna to ring in this new year. I was fascinated by a December 2011 FoxNews.com article that reported the number of licensed radio amateurs in the United States is at an all-time high. According to the article, the FCC has on record 700,314 licenses, with nearly 40,000 new ones in the last 5 years. Compare that with 2005, when only 662,600 people hammed it up, and you'll see why. The American Radio Relay League, the authority on all things ham, is calling it a golden age. There are many that feel that modern technology has diminished classic modes of communications. I disagree. I believe new technology has made the traditional modes more attractive and expansive, and ham radio leads the way in that regard. YLs are now able to connect off-air via the internet and social media, such as Facebook and Twitter, as well as on the air. Online, you can talk to hundreds of people at once and make new contacts online that you may have missed on the air during a time zone difference or poor propagation. This cross-connectivity has only served to augment our hobby. Last year, I accepted invitations to join international YL groups that I otherwise would not have known about had I not been active on social media. One of those groups is YLs in the World. Diego Ciorotiri, Italian call sign IZ2OAR, of Carit Bresna, near Milan, Italy, started this group on Facebook with the purpose of being, quoting, a tribute to all the YLs of the world, close quote. The group has 193 members hailing from the United States, Australia, New Zealand, France, Spain, Italy, Portugal, Indonesia, Russia, India, China, Brunei, and Japan, to name just a few. The membership grows every day as Diego and his administrators invite any YLs, as well as a few OMs, that's the old men or the husbands, to join. Karine Lacker, F5ISY, of France, invited me to another Facebook site called The Days of YLs, 21 and 22 May 2011. That's the actual title, folks. The group hopes to gather all women amateurs in the world as they choose one day in the year to be on the airwaves. The group has 1,065 members so far and is taking suggestions on which date would be best to mount the International Women's Day. For the most part, though, the members announce international QSOs, post photos of their rigs, and rag chew a bit. The same thing we do when we're on the air. Good thing, not much changes in the ham world. Now, regarding Above and Beyond, and talk about marrying modern technology with old-school ham radio, amateur radio on the International Space Station seeks to lead the way to influence the next generation toward careers in math, science, engineering, and technology. ARIS runs a volunteer program that allows students to communicate with the International Space Station, the ISS, on orbit cruise using amateur radio. Students learn firsthand about life on the ISS, and they get to explore Earth from space through science and math activities. This is an amazing international working group consisting of delegations from 9 countries, including the United States. The organization is run by volunteers from the National Amateur Radio Organizations and the International AMSAT, which is the Radio Amateur Satellite Corporation organizations from each country. To learn more about how to get involved or bring to ARIS an interested youngster, visit the website http://bit.ly/sfjsua. And this year's ambition for this wild columnist is to connect and interview Sonita Williams, the astronaut and YL who set an endurance record for a female in space, 195 days. That interview would be quite a coup. I will wrap up this month's column with a plug for the 2012 WILE International Meet, May 3 through 9 in Adelaide, Australia. I've been in contact with organizer Tina Clogg, VK5TMC, about the event, and she is ecstatic to have 70 registrations from around the world, Germany, Denmark, Sweden, England, Japan, New Zealand, and of course, Australia. 45 are YLs, with 45 OMs joining their ladies. Out of the 70, 26 plan to take the optional GON train and bus tour through the center of Australia, stopping at magnificent places like Alice Springs, Kings Canyon, and finishing up in Darwin. She wants everyone to know that there is still plenty of room for more registrations. If you are interested in the GON excursion, she needs your registration soon, as final payments on this portion is due by February 17, 2012. For more information about the 2012 WILE International Meet, you can contact her directly via email. Her email is her call sign, vk5tmc@bigpond.com. That's a call, vk5tmc@bigpond.com. And again, if you're interested, you can send information via the Postal Service, writing to Tina, T-I-N-A, Clogg, C-L-O-G-G, VK5TMC, P.O. Box 78, O'Halloran Hill, S.A., Australia, 5158. However we connect this year, on the air, online, or face-to-face, it's all good. Happy New Year. Signed, Jennifer, K-I-6-O-I-L. Let's conclude with a commentary by Bill Sexton and 1IM regarding some of the steps that are being taken for amateur unity and interoperability with other functioning organizations. Bill represents the Mars faction in amateur radio. The piece I'm going to read from is titled, "With the Pentagon on Your Club's Turf." Members better be ready for anything. It was a few autumns ago on an unseasonably warm Monday when David Jordan, WA3GIN, took his bus to inspect the newly equipped Arlington County, Virginia, Emergency Operations Center. The predominantly urban county lies just across the Potomac from downtown Washington, D.C. It teems with the overflow of federal installations and related businesses. But oddly enough, the county had never had a dedicated contingency communication facility before. Well, better late than never. In this case, a lot better. That Monday happened to be September 10, 2001. The next morning, terrorists crashed American Airlines Flight 77 into the Pentagon's west face. The disaster scene lay clearly visible across Arlington National Cemetery, barely 2 miles from OEC's county campus location. Liaison personnel from public safety and other supporting agencies quickly took up positions there for direct contact with the ARLCO, that's Arlington County Incident Command. Dave Jordan's career in informational technology, plus his extra-class amateur radio license, had won him the task of helping create the EOC out of a little used conference room. Recalling its debut, literally under fire, he said he had just become aware of the World Trade Center attack that September morning when, quoting, there was a sudden boom, boom. You could feel our building shake, he said. Looking out the window, we could see smoke billowing from the Pentagon. That was the start of a very long day, yes. The EOC was chaotic. And yes, somewhat noisy, because at the time of 9/11, we hadn't had the benefit of NIMS training. But all the agencies that responded did a super job. The Unforgettable Day launched Darlington County's development of somewhat unusual architecture for the role of amateur radio in emergency support. As Jordan explains it, we found very early after 9/11 that the traditional structure didn't respond to the needs of the government. Interestingly, emergency communications wasn't his job description before 9/11. He had joined the county's Department of Technology Services only that April, with responsibility for information security and privacy issues. His previous career involved computer and communications engineering at high-tech corporations like ADP, MCI, 3M, and SBS. Jordan's amateur radio experience began while an eighth grader. Dave had found a beat-up five-tube radio in a pile of discarded junk from a neighbor's spring cleaning. His father said he could keep it only if he could make it work. With some outside help, he succeeded and was captivated hearing distant hams conversing over vast distances. He got his first license that year, 1963. In later life, putting his network design expertise at the service of his hobby, Jordan can now remotely operate his home station from anywhere there's internet connectivity. An impressive comprehensive antenna farm includes a self-designed, full-size 40-meter Yagi with three elements, the longest being 72 feet. So he was a logical choice for RACIS radio officer when the county launched its Auxiliary Communications System, ACS, in 2005, just before Hurricane Katrina, another instance of lucky timing. Two significant organizational footnotes apply here. First, Arlington County's amateur responders operate within the formal mandate of RACIS, but the scope of operation reaches well beyond the traditional RACIS boundaries. Second, their organization doesn't wear the ACS label. It's the Arlington Radio Public Service Club, Inc., ARPSC. The word amateur, as in amateur radio, is omitted by design. The club has good use for both non-hams and professional specialists. As an incorporated nonprofit, it can accept donations alongside county, state, and FEMA funding. Jordan cites a number of reasons for the unorthodox approach. There was the considerable number of separate organizations offering much of the same services, like ARIS, Amateur Radio Emergency Service, and RACES, the Federally Chartered Radio Amateur Civil Emergency Service, and MARS, the Defense Department's three-branch military auxiliary radio system. Unhelpful duplicate or competitive activity seemed inevitable. There was the additional problem that the various services such organizations offer don't necessarily correspond to what an agency needs. Quoting here, we have 60,000 Defense Department employees coming to work every day in Arlington County, he said. The loose arrangements you have in some volunteer organizations just aren't acceptable. There's no way that expectations can be assured. Jordan said an initial public appeal for a few good amateur radio operators, that was a quote, just after Katrina produced a huge response. But membership requirements are stiff, including RACIS eligibility, completion of locally developed basic communications training, personal background check, motor vehicle qualification, regular net and exercise participation, and completion of NIMS-ICS courses. The county wanted customized training that fit its unique situation, a jurisdiction that, besides the Pentagon, hosts National Airport, the new $89 million National Guard Readiness Center, multiple bridge portals, and many underground metro rail stations. Half a dozen years after its debut, ARPSC membership is holding at 30. That includes members from outside the immediate area to substitute in the event of an incident that incapacitates in-town personnel. ARPSC facilities put it in the front rank of MCOM organizations. These facilities include complete VHF and UHF coverage of the county with four repeaters plus remote receivers, a growing intralinking other county offices and hospitals, text alert system, HF and NVIS capabilities, and a unique mobile emergency technology support unit that provides high-speed intranet and internet access to users and other communications vehicles, multiple video connections allowing video conferencing in the field, and mobile data storage with access to the county's stationary resources. September 11, 2001 is considerably more than another anniversary event here. Jordan remembers his feeling that morning. In quotations, "For the first time in my life, the first time in our history, the continental U.S. had been attacked. That was hard to get your head around. It meant everything was going to change forever, though what and how was yet to be determined. Well, we're still on watch," he said. "The homeland will never be so easily attacked again." Ladies and gentlemen, that just about completes the reading here on the Courage Handy Ham System of World Radio Magazine, the online version for February 2012. World Radio is a publication of CQ Communications, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Handy Ham is spelled H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M. That's lowercase. handyham@courage.org. Our website, www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH, or geographic location, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts. Thanks again for listening along with me here on the Courage Handy Ham System, 73.